We started reading through the letter that Paul the Apostle wrote to the Christians in Rome. And last week we were thinking about this statement which Paul makes in chapter 1, verse 18. He says, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men." Paul talks here about God's wrath. So we asked, what does that word mean? Answer: it means anger. But I pointed out that the English word anger covers a whole range of different feelings and reactions. It can just mean that somebody loses their temper temporarily. It's just a passing feeling. It doesn't necessarily affect your attitude long term to whoever it is you're angry with. But there are times when the word anger means something very different. There are times when it means you're deep set, steady, deliberate hostility to someone who has acted in a way that you think is abhorrent. And that's the sort of anger Paul is talking about here. It's an attitude rather than just an emotion. Paul is telling us that God has that attitude of hostility. But against whom? Against whom is God's wrath directed? Well, Paul answers, it's directed against all the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And the word men there just means human beings, humanity. Not some human beings, but the human race together. Paul is telling us that God's attitude towards human beings everywhere is one of settled, steady anger. Paul says that that anger is revealed from heaven. In other words, though God is in heaven, far removed from us, invisible to us, his wrath can be seen operating here on earth. If we look around us, there are signs, there are visible signs everywhere that God is angry. And Paul tells us why God is angry. He's angry because of the ungodliness and unrighteousness of the human race. Ungodliness. The word means treating God wrongly, failing to give God what is due to him. Some human beings ignore God. Some pretend he's not there. Some treat him with contempt. Some rage against him. Some misrepresent him. Some try to use him for their own ends. But one way or another, the human race is guilty of ungodliness. And coupled with that is unrighteousness, which is a broader word. Unrighteousness means all the ways in which human beings do evil. It includes the way that they treat God, but then it also covers all the other evil things they do. It covers all their evil thoughts and evil words and evil actions. It covers selfishness and pride and greed and perversion, wrong attitudes, wrong priorities. Unrighteousness covers every human sin. So Paul's telling us that God is angry with humanity. He tells us that if we only look around, we'll see the evidence of God's anger. It's all around us. And he tells us why God is angry with human beings. First, because of the wicked way they've acted towards him. And then because of all the wickedness that they're guilty of. But Paul wants us to understand still more about God's anger and what has provoked it. He goes on to explain just how our ungodliness shows itself. He wants us to see that we've got no excuse for our ungodliness. He wants us to recognize that God has every reason to be angry with us. And he wants us then to see how our ungodliness, our wrong attitude to God, has led to all our unrighteousness, all the other wickedness that you see among human beings. What's man's greatest crime? What is the starting point of human sinfulness? What is it that triggered God's wrath? Paul says, God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who in their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Human beings suppress the truth. The truth about what? Paul explains in verse 19. What can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. The truth that Paul is talking about, the truth that human beings suppress, is the truth about God. The truths that God has made plain to human beings through creation. Paul says anyone who looks at the world that God has created, anyone who looks up at the sky above him, anyone who looks at the oceans and the dry land, anyone who looks at the beasts and the birds, anyone who looks at his own body with all its astonishing capabilities, anyone who looks at the human brain, more powerful than all the computers on earth put together, anyone who looks at the living cell, or the design of the DNA molecule, anyone who looks at a single atom and the forces that bind it together, has in front of him the plainest evidence that the world was created. It didn't just spring out of nowhere and nothing. The fact that our universe began demands that something was there before the universe. Nothing comes from nothing. Behind, beyond the universe, there must be an eternal something that caused it all. And when you see the order, the beauty, the infinite complexity of the universe, then you know that that something has to be a someone, a personal being, limitless in power and intelligence. a being who made it all and holds it all together, so that all the different parts and forces of the universe work together in unison. The very fact that the universe exists is the evidence that God exists. And every single thing we see and hear and touch and taste is evidence of His majesty, His divine nature. He's the ultimate fact. He's the reason for everything. Everything else that exists is there because He chose to create it. It's there for Him. And that includes us. We exist only because He chose to bring us into existence. That's the truth that human beings are constantly suppressing. They don't want to think of God in that way. They don't want to think of Him as the one for whom they exist, the one on whom they're dependent every moment, the one to whom they owe everything, the one who will call them to account one day. So they close their eyes to the plain evidence that God has given them, the evidence of His eternal power and divine nature. So Paul says, they are without excuse. That's there at the end of verse 20. They are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour Him as God or give thanks to Him. You know, if there really were no evidence for the fact that God is there, if we really had no way of knowing what He's like, His eternal power, His divine nature, then we would have an excuse for ignoring Him. We couldn't be expected to honour Him. We couldn't be expected to give thanks to Him. But God has given us all the evidence we need. So now, if we fail, when we fail to honour Him as we should, He has every reason to be angry, because we're closing our eyes to a mountain of evidence. Now, what was the principal way in which people in Paul's day suppressed the truth about God and failed to honour Him? Paul tells us the answer to that in the second half of verse 17 and on into verse 18. He says this: they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the invisible God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Paul says this is what happened to human beings everywhere, all across the earth. They didn't want to believe in the real God, the invisible creator, the all-powerful divine person to whom they owed everything. So they pushed Him out of their minds. But did that leave them free, enlightened? No, their thinking just became more and more confused and cloudy. They became futile in their thinking. Their foolish hearts were darkened. Getting rid of the truth about God just left a vacuum in their thinking, a vacuum that had to be filled. They had to find alternative explanations for the world and the things that happen in the world. They had to have some sort of gods to fall back on, but gods that suited them better, gods that they could control and use. So they made their own gods. They invented all sorts of gods for themselves, and they set up images, idols, to represent those gods. And they started worshipping the idols. They produced images of all sorts. Some of them, Paul says, were shaped like human beings. Some of them were supposed to look like birds or animals or creepy crawlies. That was true all over the world. Everywhere you had human beings, you had idol worship. Sheer insanity. You can see why Paul says that their foolish hearts were darkened. You can see why he says they became fools. Just think about what he says. They chose to worship images resembling mortal man. You know, if they were to worship one another, their fellow human beings, that would be crazy enough, because human beings are obviously weak, helpless creatures. They're mortal, they get old, they can't keep themselves alive, they die, every one of them. No human being can really answer your needs. But idol worshippers aren't even worshipping other human beings. Instead, they're just worshipping lumps of stone or wood carved to look like human beings. Or crazier still, carved to look like animals or birds or snakes or whatever. As Paul says, they exchange the glory of the invisible God for that. They don't want to worship God in all his glory, his majesty, but they'll worship those pathetic, lifeless statues. What an insult to the real God, that human beings close their eyes to him, and instead, they start worshipping bits of wood and stone. As I said, idol worship was universal when Paul wrote this letter. You could travel anywhere in the world and you would find people worshipping their images. There was one nation that officially rejected the idea of worshipping idols. That was Paul's own nation, the Jews. But Jewish history showed how deeply idol worship was rooted even in their thinking. Again and again, the Jewish people turned back to idol worship. They knew more about the real God than any other nation. But they didn't want him any more than other nations did. So again and again, back to their idols they would go. They saw God working in amazing ways, but still back to their idols they would go. In Paul's time, Jewish people, generally speaking, didn't set up their idols publicly, but still their idolatry was there. It just took another form. People carried magic amulets, magical bowls, all sorts of magical objects. And again, they talked as if those things had power to help them, to protect them, to give them their wishes. It was just idolatry in a different disguise. What is the great attraction of idolatry? Why did human beings everywhere choose to go down that road? I think it's simple. If you have an idol and you put that in the place of God, it means you've got a God you can control. You can carry it with you, and it's got no choice whether to come or not. You can put it away in a cupboard if you don't want it to see what you're doing. You can carry it into battle so it has to fight for you or be captured by the enemy. People, human beings, want gods that will always do what they want. That'll always be there at their beck and call. What they don't want is the real God. They don't want a God who's invisible, infinite, supreme, and who deserves total submission, total surrender, total obedience. But we don't worship idols today, do we? Human beings have grown out of that, haven't they? Well, at least in the Western world. Really? People in the UK don't worship things that they make with their own hands? Just witness the excitement when a new model iPhone comes out. The queues of people who have to have it on the first day of sale, regardless of the price. Think of youngsters desperate for the latest trainers or the newest football strip. Think of people who really believe that Ozempic or Viagra tablets are going to turn them into the sort of person they dream of being. They really imagine that these things, things invented by human beings, will bring them safety and satisfaction and well-being. They won't give a thought to the infinite, glorious God who made all things, but they'll believe that these man-made products have the power to make their lives worth living. And unlike God, they can buy those things for money. And they can have them at their beck and call. They can put them in their pocket, or they can keep them in their bathroom cupboard, and all will be well. It's just the same ungodliness. It's the same idolatry. It just takes a more modern, more scientific sounding and form. Anyone who thinks that something other than God himself can meet his needs, or the needs of the human race, is insulting God. Anyone who takes something that God has made, or that human beings themselves have made, and puts that something in the place of God himself, is provoking God. It may be a particular possession. It may be a friend. It may be your family, your home, your own body. Treat anything as if it's all important, as if it can be a substitute for God, your creator, and you're calling down God's wrath on yourself. And that's what we've all done in one way or another. We're all guilty of ungodliness. Now, go back to Paul's words in verse 18. That God's wrath is revealed from heaven. In other words, you can see the signs of God's wrath here in this world. Let's ask the question now, how is God's wrath revealed? Well, in many ways. We're told right back in the first book of the Bible that when the first human beings rebelled against God, that God cursed the ground for man's sake. And the result of that was that everything in the whole created world was damaged, spoiled. Everything malfunctions. That's why there are earthquakes and tidal waves. That's why there are famines. That's why there's disease and deformity. That's why there's pain. That's why there's death. God pronounced a death sentence on human beings. Dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Every tragedy, every pang of pain, every case of starvation, every funeral is God's wrath showing itself here in this world. I should add that that doesn't mean that when those things happen to particular people, it's the sign that those people are more guilty than other people. That God is more angry with them than he is with others. No, as we've seen, Paul is talking about the whole human race. And these things come on the whole human race. Where's the human being who doesn't experience pain or unhappiness or in the end death? The whole earth is cursed. The whole of the human race experiences the consequences of our sin. So we have those signs. We have the proofs that the human race has wronged God and that God is reacting in wrath. Paul surely has all that in mind when he says that God's wrath is revealed from heaven. But beyond those things, there is one particular way in which God's wrath is revealed here in this world. And it's that which Paul particularly has in mind. I want you to look down the page and see one phrase which Paul uses three times. You'll see it in verse 24. You'll see it again in verse 26. You'll see it again in verse 28. Do you see it? God gave them up. Or in some translations, God handed them over. They're both accurate translations of what Paul wrote in Greek. God handed human beings over. God gave them up. To what? God handed them over to what? To suffering? To illness? To death? Well, yes, but that's not what Paul's talking about here. Let's take the first. God gave them up. Verse 24. God gave them up in the lusts of their heart to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves. God gave them up to impurity, to dirtiness, to shameful and disgusting patterns of behaviour. God allowed their hearts to be filled with lusts. The punishment for turning away from the real God, rejecting him, choosing false gods, idols, was that God took away all restraint from human beings. And they started to behave in sick ways. Paul's got in mind especially all the ways in which human sexuality became distorted. He says God gave them over to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves. It was God who created sexuality. God created human beings as sexual creatures with the capacity to find great satisfaction and pleasure through their relationships with one another. But he said how their sexual capacities were to be used. He laid down a beautiful blueprint. A man and a woman would come together. They'd give themselves to one another without reservation in a relationship of trust and intimacy and love, and nobody else would be allowed to come between them. They'd be bound together for life. They'd be secure in their faithful love to one another. And from their union would come children whom they would bring up together. And their relationship would grow deeper and deeper as they came to know one another better and better. They'd never get bored with one another, never get frustrated with one another. Their relationship would never be spoiled by jealousy or malice or selfishness. That was how human sexuality was supposed to function. It was to be the source of the deepest happiness that human beings could ever know, except for the happiness to be found in God Himself. But now think of how human sexuality actually functions here in this world. The uncontrollable lusts to which human beings are subject. And all the outcome of that, betrayal, promiscuity, rape, prostitution, paedophilia, pornography, sadism, masochism, other perversions which I'm not prepared even to name here. These are the things that have characterized human relationships all down through the centuries. How is it that human beings choose such degraded and misery-causing patterns of behavior? How can they take something that was created so beautiful and twist it to cause so much shame and pain? You know, there are many animals that mate for life, and the monogamous. Male and female become partners. They care for one another. They help one another. They never betray one another. It's like that with some of the apes. Gibbons, a male and a female, are drawn to one another. Do you know how? By sharing a song. They'll perform a series of mating calls as a duet. And his call and hers become a single song, which they'll then perform together for the rest of their lives. Isn't that lovely? But then you look at human relationships across the world and throughout history, and what people have done, the ruin they've inflicted upon one another. And you see how far we are from the sort of behavior that Gibbons find normal and natural. How do you explain it? Well, Paul's explanation is simple. He says God handed human beings over. God stripped human beings of the restraints which even apes or beavers exhibit. He handed human beings over to live in more and more degraded and twisted ways. Why did he do it? Verse 25. Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And they worshipped and served the creature, created things, rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. That was the primary sin. They exchanged the truth about God and chose to believe lies. They worshipped and served created things, idols, rather than worshipping the Creator. And God said, the way I am going to punish them for that is by stripping them of the capacity to live wise, loving lives. If they won't have me, they won't have my gifts. One of God's loveliest and greatest gifts to human beings was the capacity to live together as men and women in marriage, to enjoy one another in love and intimacy. God says, if they're determined not to have me, then I'm going to strip away all of that and leave them to live lives of filth. The punishment for sin is sin. When men and women sin against God, when they refuse to have him as their God, God hands them over to every other sin. And nowhere is that more evident, more apparent, than in the breakdown of the relationships that ought to exist between men and women. That's how God's wrath is revealed in the world. When you see men abusing women, and when you see women subjecting themselves to brutal men, and when you see relationships being broken up in bitterness and rage, and when you see men slipping in and out of strip joints and sex shops, always looking for one more sordid experience, when you see girls of 15 or 16 working on the streets, selling their bodies, you say, this is God's wrath at work. This is God who has handed human beings over to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves. Oh, what a judgment. It's terrifying, isn't it? We think of suffering as the punishment of sin. But no, the first and most horrible punishment of sin is sin. God hands human beings over to spiral deeper and deeper down into sin. Do you know what hell is? Hell is the place where God has finally handed human beings over and taken away all restraints, so that human beings are locked into their sin forever, and where every last trace of goodness has been stripped away from them. So now all there is lust, lust that can never be satisfied, and rage, rage which can never be quenched, and bitterness, bitterness which can never be soothed, and hatred, hatred which can never finally burn itself out. That's what hell is. God hands those who will not have him, he hands them over to a bottomless pit of evil. The wrath of God is revealed. How glad I am that I have a Saviour. How glad I am that God sent his Son into the world to save me from my sin, to break that chain. How glad I am that Jesus was willing to take the wrath of God upon himself, that I might be set free. And how glad I am that I have the truth of the gospel to tell to others. What else have we got to give to people in this ruined, broken society where people have been given over. What other hope is there for them other than Jesus Christ? Jesus Christ and his gospel, which is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes.